Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
U.S. President Donald Trump spoke at the 73rd meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, praising national sovereignty and warning Iran and Venezuela. In his speech on Tuesday, Trump urged representatives of member nations to have pride in their own nations and to seek prosperity together. The U.S. president did not single out one nation with severe language, as he did with North Korea during last year's speech. However, Trump did criticize Iran strongly, calling its leaders corrupt. He added that the nation does not respect its neighbors or borders and continues to support terrorism. Trump also criticized the nuclear agreement with Iran, from which the U.S. withdrew in May. He said the U.S. would increase pressure on Iran and urged nations to cut oil imports from it. The president also announced a new campaign of economic pressure on Iran. Additional restrictions will go into effect on November 5th. Trump noted that since sanctions had been lifted, Iran had increased its military budget by nearly 40%. Trump said Iran had an agenda of aggression and expansion. The U.S. president also called for restoring democracy in Venezuela. He said Venezuela had once been the richest country in South America, but the socialist policies of President Nicolas Maduro had made it extremely poor. He announced additional sanctions that would target Venezuelan officials and close allies of Maduro. Trump praised his administration's efforts to meet and negotiate with North Korea's leaders. Trump met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore on June 12th to discuss efforts to end North Korea's banned nuclear weapons program. Trump thanked Kim for the steps he has taken. However, Trump noted that much work remains to be done. United Nations Security Council sanctions remain in place. North Korea announced plans to take apart a nuclear testing center and a missile launch site last week. In addition to Kim, Trump thanked leaders in Northeast Asia who have been involved in negotiations with North Korea. He gave special thanks to South Korean President Moon Jae-in and also to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Trump called his administration's foreign policy one of principled realism. He called for agreements reached years ago with trade partners to be renegotiated so they are, in his words, fair to the United States. The president also called for reform to the world trade system, saying that trade must be fair and reciprocal. Trump announced that newly placed U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods brought the total value of Chinese products facing import taxes to $250 billion. In speaking about import taxes meant to help American businesses, the president said, "America will never apologize for protecting its citizens." Trump praised Gulf countries in the Middle East, including the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. These countries, the president said, have promised to work toward peace in Yemen, which is suffering a civil war. However, he criticized OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, for high oil prices. The United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar are all members of OPEC. Trump said oil prices must be brought down soon. Trump began his speech to the international body by talking about the extraordinary progress made under his administration. He noted that unemployment for African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans had reached historic lows, while stock market values have hit record highs. Trump caused a moment of levity when he praised what his administration had accomplished as almost unmatched.
"In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay."
Trump did not apologize for calling on other nations to share more of the costs of UN activities and international aid. He said his administration would take a hard look at U.S. foreign assistance. He also said the U.S. would no longer pay more than 25% of the UN peacekeeping budget. I'm Mario Ritter.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in was able to reach several agreements with North Korea's leader during a three-day meeting last week. Moon's trip also added energy to slowing talks on efforts to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program. On Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump said he could hold a second meeting with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, in his words, quite soon. But some observers worry that North Korea's human rights record has not been part of the discussions. In 2014, the United Nations Office of Human Rights Commission of Inquiry released a report. It accused North Korea of gross human rights violations. It said many of the violations may be crimes against humanity. The report went on to say that the human rights violations in North Korea were unequaled in the world. In a statement, South Korea's presidential office said Moon plans to work with the international community to develop a plan for peace between the two Koreas. But human rights supporters told VOA they are concerned. Steps toward peace, reconciliation, and even reunification, they say, are good signs. But human rights has not been part of the talks. Greg Scarlatoyu is executive director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. He said agreements have been reached between South and North Korea in declarations from meetings in Panmunjom in April and in September. But, he said, human rights policies have not been involved in the South's discussions with the North. Phil Robertson is Deputy Asia Director for the group Human Rights Watch. He did point to one point of progress, the important humanitarian reunification between the separated families. In August, North Korea permitted some families from the South to visit with their relatives who were separated by the Korean War. South Korea's Ministry of Unification administers the Council on North Korean Human Rights and works closely together with other agencies. The ministry said it will put forth a plan for human rights in North Korea and carry out policies that support it. In an email to VOA, the Unification Ministry wrote, "The government places emphasis on human rights." The ministry also said it works to continuously improve the quality of life for North Koreans. I'm Susan Shand.
A growing number of American states are requiring schools to teach students how to judge information on the internet and social media. California is the latest state to pass such a requirement. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown signed a law aimed at helping educators teach students media literacy skills. Media literacy, also known as news literacy, is the ability to use critical thinking skills to recognize differences between real and fake news. Fake news are stories that appear to be news but are in fact false or misleading. The new law requires California's Department of Education to provide materials related to media literacy on its website. The materials are designed to inform teachers and provide tools for them to teach the subject. California State Senator Bill Dodd proposed the bill, which became law. He said the goal is to give students a set of effective tools to empower them to make informed decisions. He added that news literacy is important for students and society to help safeguard the future of democracy. Todd told VOA that his media literacy efforts were based on a Stanford University study from 2016. It found that 80% of U.S. middle school students failed to recognize an advertisement that looked like a real news story. The ad was even identified as sponsored content. The researchers also found that high school students had trouble telling the difference between a real Facebook news website and a fake news site. The study called for more efforts to help students recognize false information on the internet and social media services. It said that young people also need the skills to find out where news stories come from and to be able to judge the trustworthiness of sources and writers. Dodd said he wanted his bill to go even further and to include the creation of full media literacy training in all classrooms. But he said there was not enough legislative support for providing the money needed for such an effort. Dodd did say he thinks that once the new teaching materials become available, lawmakers will be more willing to expand the program. Other states have also passed legislation to bring news literacy education to the classroom. Others are considering new measures. The bill passed in California is similar to one approved last year in Washington state. It created a web-based system of materials for teachers. The Washington law also required education officials to report on how they plan to add media literacy education to local schools. A bill was under consideration last year in New Mexico. It called for a new life skills requirement for those completing their education. The bill would require students to study media literacy as part of a class covering life skills in order to graduate. The state's House of Representatives has yet to pass the measure. A proposal before Hawaii's legislature would develop a statewide plan to teach media literacy skills at all levels in public schools. That bill is still under consideration. Carolyn Eddy is a professor of communication at Appalachian State University in North Carolina. She told VOA she has seen a clear change in her students' abilities to judge news sources as they have grown on the internet and across social media. Eddie said that when students used to read printed newspapers, it was easier for them to recognize fact from opinion. Now she finds it necessary to teach students how to fully examine websites. "It's a big problem for a lot of people," she said. One of Eddie's goals is to teach students how to research the news organizations responsible for the stories they are reading. One way to do this is for students to ask a series of questions. One example she gives is, what is the overall mission of the organization? Another would be, do they use professional news gathering and reporting methods? Eddie says young people also need to judge whether news organizations identify any possible conflicts of interest. Another question to ask is, what do they do when they get a story wrong? Responsible and trustworthy news organizations issue corrections if something is falsely reported, she said. Eddie added that one good thing to come out of the rise of misinformation and fake news is that it has made many people seek out good reporting. "I've had some of the most engaged students I've ever had, and that's really exciting," she said. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Monroe easily won election in 1816. He had a relaxed, likable personality and was popular with voters. In addition, many saw him as a last connection to the country's founding generation. Monroe had fought in George Washington's army during the Revolutionary War against British rule. He was a diplomat during Thomas Jefferson's presidency and helped complete the Louisiana Purchase. Monroe served as James Madison's Secretary of State and briefly as his Secretary of War as well during the War of 1812. Voters' positive feelings carried Monroe into office and defined his presidency. When Monroe became president, the United States had just declared victory against British forces in the War of 1812. The American economy was also doing well, at least at first. And the government was mostly united under a single party. But Monroe did have one immediate problem. He and his wife, Elizabeth, could not move into the president's house right away. The British had burned it badly in an attack on Washington, D.C. Workers were busy making repairs. So Monroe decided to go on a trip. He spent the first weeks of his presidency traveling. He went north into New England, visiting important places from the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812. Everywhere he went, he reminded Americans of their shared, proud history. He even wore clothes in the old colonial style. One of Monroe's nicknames is the Last of the Cocked Hats. Then President Monroe turned west, toward lands that white migrants were increasingly settling. They were able to move west in part because American soldiers had defeated a powerful alliance of Native American tribes. What had been a victory for the U.S. government was a crushing loss for Native Americans. Many tribes moved farther west. Others began to lose their languages and their customs as white settlers took control. For Monroe, however, the visit west was a positive sign of the country's expansion. By the time he returned to Washington, Monroe had met many Americans. He had learned for himself the geography of the country, and he had demonstrated that all parts of the U.S. could be connected by patriotism and a common federal government. One newspaper called Monroe's presidency the beginning of an era of good feelings. 4 years later, Monroe won a second term even more easily than his first. Yet James Monroe's presidency had several crises. One was the country's first economic depression in more than 30 years. Another was over slavery. The country had been divided over the issue since its founding. By the end of 1819, 11 states, all in the South, permitted slavery. 11 states, all in the North, did not. The question became, would the new states in the West permit it? Monroe had to face the question when settlers asked Congress permission for Missouri Territory to become a state. Many enslaved people already lived there. White settlers expected to bring more. But a member of Congress from a northern state proposed that Missouri could become a state only if it banned slavery. That proposal started a debate that lasted more than a year. For the most part, the debate was not based on the moral problems with people owning other people. Instead, it involved economic and political concerns. Northerners argued that slaveholding states had an unfair economic advantage. In addition, if Missouri entered the Union as a slave state, its lawmakers would move the balance of power toward the South. The debate continued so long that another area asked to enter the Union. People in northern Massachusetts wanted to organize into an independent state called Maine. After some time, lawmakers offered a compromise. They said Maine could be admitted as a free state and Missouri as a slave state. But they also made a line across a map of the country. They said Congress would not admit another slave state north of that line. James Monroe signed into law what became known as the Missouri Compromise. It settled the issue of slavery, at least officially, in the U.S. for more than 20 years. But everyone knew that the peace between pro-slavery and anti-slavery groups was only temporary. In 1823, Monroe made one of the most important foreign policy decisions in American history. It became known as the Monroe Doctrine. It related to Spain's colonies in Latin America. Monroe had dealt with Spain before. In his first term, he and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, successfully negotiated with Spain to buy Florida for the United States. By Monroe's second term, Spain had also lost control of some of its former colonies in Latin America. The president became concerned that Spain's European allies would try to help the country regain power. He did not want European powers interfering in areas so close to U.S. territory and so important to U.S. trade. So Monroe gave a speech to Congress. He said, the U.S. would stay out of Europe's affairs. But, he said, Europe should also stay out of Latin America's affairs. And Monroe declared that European powers would not be permitted to begin colonizing any area in the Western Hemisphere. In other words, Monroe declared that the U.S. considered the entire Western Hemisphere its sphere of influence. Historians note that Monroe did not aim for the Declaration to be a major statement, but it became a base of American foreign policy and supported U.S. expansion throughout the 19th century. James Monroe was the fourth and last president in the Virginia dynasty. Except for John Adams, four of the first five American presidents were from Virginia. Monroe and his wife returned to their home there after he left office. They had a close relationship with each other, as well as with their two surviving children, both daughters. Unlike many politicians of his time, Monroe had brought his family with him on his travels. He also believed strongly in education for girls. When the Monroes lived in France, young Eliza Monroe attended the best school for girls in Paris. This loving family spent as much time together as possible. So, when Elizabeth Monroe died, James Monroe was filled with sorrow. His health also began to fail. He moved to the house of his younger daughter, Maria, in New York City. James Monroe died there 1 year later at age 73. Like two other former presidents, Monroe died on the 4th of July, America's birthday.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.